hear me in the front and in the back. Matter of fact, I can hear myself so loud now that you'll have to turn it down a little. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is a joy and a pleasure to be with you this morning. And thank you, Brother Ishmael, for that warm welcome. I want you to know that I've already booked in a raise for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
However, because I am so frugal, it's only 1%.
It's better than nothing.
Better than nothing. That's right. That's right. Well, the topic, of course, for the entire camp meeting, the theme is the time is near. This morning, for a few minutes, I want to explore with you what we do during this near time. What do we occupy ourselves with? How did Jesus occupy himself with the near time that he had? And so this morning I want to look at with you a passage that's familiar and yet still has much to be discovered. And it's found in John chapter 4. If you have a means of looking at that passage, by all means turn to it. It's a familiar passage about the woman at the well. John chapter 4. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we thank you this morning. We are grateful that we can share these few moments together to see how Jesus spent this near time, near for him to the time when he would give his life on the cross. For us, the near time to his return once more. Bless us as we learn from this encounter with the woman at the well. Let me give you a little bit of background about this particular story. I don't know if any, as some of you have been to Israel here, right? A few of you, I'm sure, have been over there and done that tour of the Holy Land. We had the privilege of doing that in Ontario once every session, which is a five-year period. They plan an education experience for the pastors and for members to go. So I went on one of those and had that privilege of being over there. The land where Jesus walked, this land we call Israel, is really divided more or less in three layers. You've seen these jello layers, you know, different colors. Israel is like that. It has three layers. The layer to the very north is called Galilee. That's the northern portion of the land of Israel. Then there is the southern area, which is the most common area that people are acquainted with, and that's the area around Jerusalem. And that area, if you go to the east, you go down to Jericho and so forth. That is familiar. And then there's a layer in between that most people don't mention a great deal, but it's referred to here this morning, and that is the area of Samaria. So Samaria lay smack in the middle between Jerusalem and to the north, Nazareth and Galilee and that particular area. And so what would happen here is that people would, of course, travel from the north to the south, but they would have to go through this in-between area. Jesus had just spent a few weeks in the southern portion, which is called Judah, and, of course, around the area of Jerusalem. He had been there conducting meetings out on the hillside, in the city, performing miracles, giving presentations, and all of that sort of thing. And came time when he decided he would make the journey back to his home. His home area was Nazareth, which was very close to the Sea of Galilee, just a little bit to the east of Galilee. You would go down to Jerusalem, or rather down to Galilee, and Capernaum and so forth was there. And he decided to make this journey back. Now, why did he make the journey back, and why on this particular occasion? It's very interesting. Look at the first three verses with me in John chapter 4. It says, "When therefore the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself was not baptizing, his disciples were. It says, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee. The issue was, is that Jesus was becoming too popular. John the Baptist had already been known and was doing a great work there, and you remember his encounter with Herod and so forth. And so they had imprisoned John. Jesus was not yet ready to be restrained in his ministry. And he feared that because of his popularity, they would perhaps imprison him or attempt to take his life prematurely. And so he didn't wish that to happen. Matter of fact, there were several occasions when Jesus had performed a miracle or something along these lines, and he would say to people, don't tell anybody about this. It was for the purpose that he did not want to become so well known and so opposed by the Pharisees and the scribes and the Romans that they would stop his ministry. And so he would be forced to travel through the countryside and to try and contain. It was a fine balancing act, because on the one hand, he wanted to expose as many people as possible to the gospel. On the other hand, he did not want to be restrained and put in prison and his ministry to be diminished. And so he decides to get out of there. It's time to take the pressure valve off for a little while and move on so that he could continue to have his freedom to speak and share and teach and heal and do all of those things. And it says in verse 4 that, well, it says it this way. It says, and he had to pass through Samaria. He had to. It wasn't like he chose to or he happened to. He had to go through Samaria. Now, it's interesting that if you are in Jerusalem and you want to go to Galilee, the most direct route is through Samaria. That is the quickest way to get there. It's roughly 70 miles to go through that particular way. People in those days who were accustomed to walking, who were used to walking, could walk roughly 25 miles in a day. That was a day's journey. If you got up in the morning early and commenced walking at 6 or so in the morning, not tearing around, but at a comfortable pace, but a steady pace, you could cover about 25 miles in a day. So it was about a 2.5-day journey if you went through Samaria. However, it was rarely ever done. Very rarely ever done. As a matter of fact, Elmira and I were there together, and it was my second time having taken this journey. And we did not go through Samaria. Still to this day, they will not take you through Samaria as an option. They will go around there. So we landed in Tel Aviv, which is right on the west side of the land, adjacent to the Mediterranean Sea, and we headed north. And we went all the way up to Galilee and then didn't come back through Samaria either. Came down on the other side of the River Jordan, all the way back down to Jericho, and made our way across. It wasn't as pleasant a journey, but it was the way still people travel there who are Jews. Most Jews chose to avoid Samaria. They avoided it in some cases at all costs. They would take any route that they could take to get around this place rather than go through it. So much so that they preferred the longer route. The longer route took them 120 miles to go there. So they would leave from where they are in Jerusalem. They would travel to their east toward Jericho, which was all downhill, down to the Dead Sea, where it was. They would go by the Inn of the Good Samaritan. We drove by there and saw that. Then we would cross the Jordan River, travel all the way up on that side of the Jordan. When we got near the Sea of Galilee, we would cross over the Jordan again. And it was 120 miles, roughly the distance between Calgary and Edmonton. And they chose to go that distance rather than go through Samaria. Much less comfortable. It was hotter. The roads were poor, but they would go to great lengths to get away from Samaria. Now, why do you think they chose to avoid Samaria at such extreme measures? Why? Why would you do that when you can go the distance in half that and a much more comfortable route to boot? So why would you do that? Well, if you review the history of Samaria, you'll understand a little bit of the background for this. In 722, Israel originally was one big land. It was all. There were 12 tribes made up Israel. But after this point in time, 722 BC, a group of people from a nation called Assyria came in and took the northern tribes captive. You read about that. The northern tribes fell first, and it was much later that Babylon came and took the southern part. So what the Assyrians did, and even the Babylonians later, was they realized that taking a country was one thing. Keeping it was another thing. And so what they would do when they conquered these lands is they would take the politicians, and they would take the architects and the engineers and the leaders and the well-educated and all of those people, and they would export them to another country. And then in return, they would send back some other group of people that they had conquered. So the Samaritans became a mixed race of individuals. They came from all nationalities and intermarried and so forth. And so they were not viewed anymore as a pure people. They were they described them as being unclean or a polluted people. That's how the Jews in Jerusalem and in the southern area viewed the Samaritans. They were, if they could have been, they would have been put on the unclean list in the Bible. And right along with grapefruit and other things like that. But that's how they were viewed. And so they were viewed as half-breeds, unclean, idol worshippers. They were not God's chosen, blue-blooded people. Of course, the Samaritans returned the favor to the Jews and hated them equally. And so they later opposed. Now, you are familiar with Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah in the Bible. Ezra, you're familiar with them. When the Babylonians had taken Israel in the south and brought them, and eventually they were allowed to come back, they decided to build Jerusalem. Remember? They built the walls, and then they built the temple and so forth. And Nehemiah had a lot of opposition. Have a guess who was opposing it? The Samaritans. That's the group of people who didn't like the Jews either. And so when they came back and tried to rebuild, they opposed them at every turn. And so there was no love lost between this two groups. As a matter of fact, while the Jews were away, the people in Samaria decided that they didn't want to go to Jerusalem anymore to worship at the temple there. So they built their own temple. And they built it on a mountain called Gerizim. And right near where Jacob's well was, right behind in the mountain, you could see, is the place where they built their temple in opposition to the temple in Jerusalem. And so they built it right there. Now, of course, the woman at the well, when she met Jesus, would look right behind her and see this place in opposition to it. The Samaritans were half-breed Israelites. So what they did was they took the Old Testament as they had it at that particular time, and they rewrote it. The five books of Moses are called the Pentateuch. That's the fancy name they give to the five books of Moses. They rewrote it. And so here's some of the things they would say in this thing. You know how Abraham had taken his son Isaac and gone up to the mountain, which is Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, and offered Isaac there. Have a guess what the Samaritan said. That Isaac was offered by Abraham on Mount Gerizim and not down in Jerusalem at all. And then they rewrote several other passages to help their understanding of the Bible and their position in the world. So they were very, very much a group of people who were in opposition to the people in the south, to Israel. So when it says here that Jesus must go through Samaria, it was not because it was a desirable place to go. It wasn't because they were the most liked people. It wasn't because they were highly esteemed. He didn't go for those reasons at all. When it says he must go, for a Jew to have must go, the reasons were not because it was a desirable place. It was going to a people that were considered to be, matter of fact, they have writings about them referring to them as dogs. That's how they viewed them. And so this isn't must in a different sense of the word. It is an intentional must. When it says Jesus must go, it was because Jesus wanted to. He intended to. He had a purpose in going, not because it was a desirable place to go. He wanted to meet this woman who would come to him at the well. A woman who was open to hearing the truth being spoken. He must go through Samaria and not around it because she needed to hear the message. And all of Samaria with her. Let me share with you that this particular story tells us a little bit about the motivation of what we are to do in this near time to the second coming, the motive for what he did. Jesus was interested in reaching the world. He was interested in reaching those who were close by. He was interested in reaching those who were a little further off. And so he was interested in going to Samaria. So what motivated Jesus to go? You know, there are many reasons we can do our sharing ministry. Call it evangelism, call it by a number of different terms. But basically just sharing the good news with somebody else. There's several motives for that, you know. And I've seen all different motives used to share the gospel. Some do it out of guilt. You know, there's a passage in the Old Testament that speaks to the watchmen of Zion that you need to do these things. And so there are some people who share out of guilt. It can work, by the way. It's not the best, not the most effective, but sometimes people will respond to you even when your motives are not pure. Others of us, many of us, we do it out of a sense of duty. We feel it's our duty, so we contribute toward evangelism because it is our duty to do so. And we support it. In various ways, if not personally, at least vicariously, through the resources that we give, we will do it. But that's not a good motive either. But sometimes people respond anyway. They take the scraps, if you will, and are able to hear about Jesus and make a decision for him, even when the messenger doesn't have the best motives. People still respond. But Jesus instead shared out of a sense of love for lost people. He was genuinely interested in people. After all, for Jesus, what mattered most was people, fallen people who would hear the gospel and make a decision. In spite of their sinful state and sinful actions, he still loved people. In spite of their constant rebellion against him and their hatred toward him, he still loved people. Jesus, after all, said, "I have come not to seek the righteous, but to seek and to save those that are lost." Lost people, like the woman at the well, meant the most to Jesus. And that was his motive. And he wanted the same motive for us. He wanted us to have a motive that said that I will do this not just because of duty. Duty's good. Not because of guilt, although sometimes even doing it for that motive, people respond. He wanted people to share the gospel because they sincerely wanted to see as many people as possible become members of God's kingdom here on earth and look forward to being members of God's kingdom to come. Reminds me once of an article I read, and it was a family looking for their family dog who had been lost. And their motive came out very clearly in the article. The note said this, you know, you see them stapled to telephone poles and things like that. It says this: "Lost black and tan dog of poodle, German shepherd, and dachshund descent. He is flea bitten. His left hind leg is missing. There's no hair on his rump. Recently neutered, answers to the name Lucky. $50 reward." And you could tell that it would take a loving family to want this dog back. You know, love can motivate you to do all sorts of things. Love can take you to places and encourage you to encounter people that you would not choose to otherwise. Let me illustrate it one more way, although I could do it a dozen ways. But, well, let me tell you this story. It may take a moment just to share it, but there was a camp meeting just like this. It happened not so long ago. And it was not our campground, but here in Alberta, it was one of our campgrounds on the other side of the border. And so one of the guest speakers was arriving that particular day. But in the morning, the work was getting complete. It was like a Friday. So the morning work goes on and life goes on. Everybody's finishing the last touches of painting and all of that kind of stuff. And so it was time to bring in the pumper truck. Now, have you seen the pumper trucks around? And they come to the various sites and so on. And they pump out the septic fields, the septic tanks. Maybe some of you on the farm have septic tanks in your yards. And so there was this big septic field, and the instruction was given to one of the helpers, go out, because the pumper truck is coming, and there's a big cover over it, and they usually put some gravel over it or dirt or whatever to conceal it. I said, go find it. Took one of these magnetic things so he could find where the lid for this big thing was, and sure enough, he dug off the dirt, and there's a big round cover that goes on this thing. And he took it off and laid it to one side, and he stuck a stick in the ground so that when the pumper truck came, he would know where to find it. He wouldn't have to spend a long time looking. Well, that very same morning, one of the speakers arrived, Friday morning, going to be presenting that evening. And of course, his wife and children had come. And so he got out of his vehicle, and they were talking away to the person who was there, telling them about the platform and what time they were starting and, you know, all of those details they were going over. After a little while of conversing and sharing and talking and so forth, he looked around, and his four-year-old daughter was not to be seen. And he looked to the right, and he looked to the left, and he looked frantically all about him, couldn't find her. And then he noticed this open cistern And she was nowhere to be seen. Now, I'll tell you, open cisterns are not an inviting place, are they? Not a place most of us spend a whole lot of time exploring around as adults. But the little girl had fallen in into the open, septic, big, monstrous tank, 10,000 gallons or whatever it was, full of putrid stuff ready to be pumped. And you know what? He was dressed in good clothes. He had a pair of dress pants. He didn't have a suit, but he had a shirt, a nice dress shirt, and his pants and shoes. Now, do you think he said to himself, "Ain't no way I'm going in there. I'm not going to mess up my good shoes. Not going to mess up my good pants." No, that didn't come in his mind at all. His love for his daughter overwhelmed anything that he had thought of, and he jumped into that thing. Jumped in and started feeling around and couldn't find her. And then he just went under, dove under, fished around in there and found her, grabbed her and got her out of there, and they were able to bring her back and resuscitate her that morning. That happened at one of our camps on the other side of the border. And so love will make you do things, take you places, encounter undesirables because you have so much love for these individuals. And Jesus, you know, when he came to this world, in comparison to heaven, we're not a pretty lot. You know, he's accustomed to the company of angels. And when he comes here and sees us all diminished by thousands of years and our minds and our intentions and all of that depraved by the effects of sin, it's something like that. But he comes because of love. So he went to this Samaritan lady for this very reason. His motive was love. He was not going to stop. Didn't matter what they thought or said about them. He must go to Samaria. It gives a picture of how God sees us. In spite of the scars of our sinful choices, the same way that he looked at the Samaritan woman, he looks at all of us, and that is by grace. Eyes that look beyond attitudes, eyes that look beyond actions and appearances, and he sees them as a fallen people in need of his great love, and so he goes there anyway. Second thing that I want you to notice about this thing is that Jesus didn't let barriers keep him from a lost people. He didn't let barriers keep him from a lost people. He was a quarter mile outside of the town of Sychar, which was right on the base of Mount Gerizim. He was at the foot of this mountain where the temple opposed the temple of the Jews. There was the famous water source known as Jacob's Well, the land Jacob had given to his son Joseph. As a matter of fact, you may remember that when Moses delivered the Israelites, one of the last acts they did was they took the remains of Joseph with them. This is where Joseph was buried, in this very area known here as the Jacob's Well. It was a great well. Matter of fact, they say, although we were not taken to Samaria because they still won't take you through Samaria. So we had not gone there. But Jesus arrives at the well at about noon, it says in verse 6. And the disciples had left to purchase some food and would come back shortly thereafter. And it was while Jesus is there, I don't know exactly the position Jesus was in, but obviously he was resting there beside the well. Perhaps he just sat with his back against the well in the little bit of shade that it provided and was very quiet, perhaps just waiting there for the disciples to return. And then comes in the distance this lady. The lady is carrying a huge water pot on her shoulder. She's not paying particular attention. She's just strolling along, going to the well at midday. And she's not noticing at all until she looks up, because the well is very close to her now, a few feet away, and she sees and identifies a man. And a man who was obviously a Jew by the way he was dressed. And she stops in mid-track, absolutely astounded and a little bit horrified, but certainly shocked and surprised to see a Jew in Samaria to start with. Have you ever gone to a place nonchalantly and discovered you were in the wrong spot? And you almost go half foot and you're shocked. That's happened to me a couple times. I'll tell you one place that happened to me was at the Toronto Pearson Airport. And I wasn't paying particularly attention, and I wanted to go to the washroom. And so I was strolling on, and from a distance they have men and women, but I didn't realize when we got closer that there was a division there. So I stroll into the washroom, not paying much attention, and when I looked up, there was only ladies around me. And someone said to me, "I think you're in the wrong place." I said, "I think you're right." And so she was shocked like that. It caught her attention. She was not expecting to see Jesus there. He was a Jew. She saw that by how he was dressed. It was midday. She went to the well at midday because she intentionally wanted to avoid people. People always went in the morning, cool of the morning, get things for breakfast if you needed it, dishes, and ready for the day. That's how you did it. You did not go in the heat of the day. That's not when you would travel, when it's 110 degrees outside. So she went there not expecting anyone. And as she approached, she was not sure if she should just turn around and leave. Perhaps if he was snoozing and didn't notice her, she would have turned around and left. But because he was alert and awake and watching, she felt kind of awkward, but she continued toward the well. And Jesus asked her the question, "Could you get me a drink of water? Could you get me a drink of water?" And she is thinking to herself, well, that's incredibly unusual. First of all, men don't speak to women at all. Not even their wives in that culture at that particular time. And certainly a Jew would never speak to her at all. Ever, under any circumstance. And then, think about this. He's asking for a drink of water from the same pot that she had drank from many, many times. Gonna drink, put his lips in the same place. You know, when I grew up as a young person in the Anglican Church, that was the faith of our family. And so it wasn't until much later that I became acquainted with Adventists, when I was in my late teens. And so at the Anglican Church, they had communion regularly. And you know, I hated communion. And the reason I hated communion is because they would hand around this jar filled with wine. And I was a little person. And the little people got the last. I was drinking. They didn't have no rags or cloths that they were wiping anything off. It was just straight on, boy. And you would take a drink and pass it to the next person. And there were people there I knew that I didn't want no mouthwash from them. And I would be last in line, and I would have to gag on this horrible stuff from about 50 others ahead of me. And it was not pleasant. And so she was thinking like this: Jesus is going to drink after me. Can you imagine? And he asked to. An incredible thing. Jesus' request for the water completely astounded her and disarmed her. He had broken several cultural barriers here. He had broken several religious boundaries. He had broken gender barriers. All of these things had been broken. He wouldn't allow anything to keep him from the people he was sent to minister to. You know what? Two of these clocks are actually accurate. You know, I was sitting last night, and I looked at these clocks, and I said, they're all over the place. Some of them don't even work. And then I noticed there are two of them that were accurate. This bigger one here in the top middle is accurate. So I don't know what time you allow me to. Are we good for another few minutes? Yeah, we're good for a few more minutes, I've been told. You'll get another raise for that. We also must be barrier breakers when it comes to reaching out to others and allowing others to hear the gospel and to hear the good news and to become part of our group of people who are looking forward to eternity. You know, there are ethnic barriers that we must overcome too. I don't know what your ethnic barrier is. I think that it depends on where you're from. Depends on your exposure to people, how many people that you've ever encountered. I grew up in a very isolated place in a little fishing village in Newfoundland. And you know what? Yeah, we had codfish, lots of codfish. I had heard that we were trading it for Jamaican rum. And so there was some place called Jamaica somewhere. And I remember the very first time we got a TV, and I was already maybe 10 years old or something. And there were people of other cultures. Wayne, there was a black person there. And I thought for sure they were just painted. I didn't know that there were really people, you know, like that. And so fortunately, I've met now many, many people. And that's not an issue, not a barrier for me. I find that one of the barriers we have today is dealing with people of Muslim faith. We hear about all these disasters overseas and all of that. And so when you walk by someone, you know, you got to really think about it and force yourself to overcome that barrier. And God wants us to do that. There are educational barriers. Sometimes we're uncomfortable with speaking with people who are either very well educated, and if we happen not to be, or vice versa. And so there are educational barriers. There are wealth barriers. Sometimes we're very uncomfortable with talking to people who have more than what we do. You know, I bought a little motorhome just before camp meeting. And it's not very big. It's all right. It's about 26, 27 feet long. It has a bedroom in the back, so that's nice. And so during workers' camp, we pulled into the field out there, and there was nobody around, only us. And I was feeling pretty good until camp meeting started. Then these mega things pulled in beside me, and I can't even see the sun for them. And now I'm very humbled again. So there are wealth barriers. There are philosophical barriers as well. People who think differently than us. I'm reluctant to say this, lest I be misunderstood. There are sexual orientation barriers as well. Now, we have a very clear stand on it, but at the same time, we must be gracious and generous and winsome, even to people who have that particular orientation. There are schedule barriers. Schedule barriers such as, you're always so busy and you got so many things to do and we've planned so many things that we really don't have time for people. That's a real barrier, especially in our culture. We need to overcome that barrier. We need to set aside our own priorities and interests from time to time so that we have time for others, time to share, time to help, time to give of ourselves. I want to talk about one other thing, because the time is going by here. And that is that this woman, when she heard the message, that salvation was available to her. And it was a Jew who was telling her this incredible news that that she could be saved too. And she said, well, have your mountain. And he said, forget about the mountains. Forget about the mountains. There's going to come a time, and is now, when people will worship spirit and in truth. Forget about the mountains. And once she grasped that salvation was available to her, that these boundaries didn't matter anymore, that it was available to her, she ran off into town and told everybody, and Jesus waited. Matter of fact, Jesus spent 2 days with them, talking to them. I don't know if she brought all five of her previous husbands, but she brought a lot of people, and they all came. Everybody came, young and the old, and she said, you know, I met somebody, and even though he knows all about me, he still offered me this incredible salvation. I think he is the Savior that we've all been looking for. Samaritans and Jews alike were waiting for the Messiah, and they all came. And for 2 days he preached the gospel to them, and many, many were converted in Samaria. I just want to finish by saying this, that all of us need to have a ministry like she did. She went. She didn't have much to offer, but she went, and the town came. All she did was invite them, and because of her character, and everybody knew about her, because of that, they came to hear, who, a Jew spoke to you? Really? Spoke to you? Yes, and he was willing to drink from the... No. You're imagining things that you would never drink from a pot that you had drunk from. That would not take place. And they came in amazement to hear this story and hear this gospel. And so she used the bit of talent and opportunity she had. All of us can have some kind of ministry. All of us. And some may sit and say, well, I'm not a public speaker. I can't get up in front of everyone. You know what? It's probably about the least effective way you can do it, is to get up in front of people. There are far better ways of doing it. Some people hear the gospel spoken and they respond. Other people see it in the lives of Christians and they make a decision without ever asking you. Some people will read their way into the message, and so on. I'll tell you a short little story about a lady. This lady, you would not prize. She was an ordinary soul. She suffered from some physical adversity, abnormalities, if you want. She was a bent over lady, and she had spinal issues. She was kind of, I wouldn't say made fun of. She wasn't made fun of, but she was not considered to be particularly of, she was not an erudite woman. She was not, you know, she was not like that. She couldn't sing. She couldn't do any of those things. She was a spinster lady who was kind of second class, you know. People tolerated her. Some people made fun of her. Some people made jokes about her. But she was a Christian lady. I could tell you her name. I could tell you where she was, but I'm not going to, because I haven't been in enough churches. You'd figure it out. Somebody would. And so this lady had a ministry. She wasn't wealthy, but she would get, you know, a government check because she was disabled and so on. So I don't know what that check was. It was not very much money. She lived with her brother and his wife and their family. And so he at least was reasonably good to her. And she had a ministry. And all she could do, she loved to read the guide magazines that would come. She would love to read the stuff she would get for Sabbath school. You know, her lesson, she faithfully read it every morning and underlined and highlighted and read all the verses and so she could talk about it in Sabbath school. And she said, well, I can't do much. But she could do a little bit of literature work, she thought. So this woman, when call portering was still in vogue, used to get some magazines and some things, and she would go door to door, this little lady, selling a few things. And what she would do with whatever money she made, she would then buy some literature, which she would use as free literature. And she went from door to door. I almost told you where, in a city, where she wasn't from. She was from outside. She went in the city and she would hand these things around. Just go along. If someone answered the door, fine, she would offer it. If they didn't, she would poke these things in the mailbox. And so that's how she spent any money she had. She would support every ministry that she knew of that the Adventist Church offered. She had no money, really. But whatever she had, that's where it went. And she did this. And one day, I was at home thinking about nothing, only supper, really. It was about 6 o'clock or so. Maybe it was 6:30, because I think we had just about finished supper. And I got this call. And there was a gentleman on the phone. And he said, you don't know me, he said, but I would like to join your church. And I thought, well, usually, I hate to say this, but very often people will use that as a ploy because then they want to have, they want you to give them some money for something, right? So they'll try and connect with you so they can get some money from the church. And so I was coy about it, a bit reluctant. Not every day somebody calls you up. It's more difficult than that. And says, I want to join your church. And I said, okay, I did my best, you know, not to be cynical, and said, yes, you know, I'd be happy to meet with you, and we can talk about this. And in my mind, I was thinking, you know, if this is even legitimate, you know, we'll have some studies together a few months down the road. Maybe I'll invite him to church, and you know how that goes, right? And he said, no. He said, I want to be baptized next week. And I said, well, I would like to meet with you. He said, sure. He said, when is your next service? And I said, well, you know, it's prayer meeting, right? It's prayer meeting on Wednesday night. And so prayer meeting is not the place I usually invite people the first time. I don't invite them to Sabbath school the first time because everybody talks. And people can say whatever they want. Sometimes it's positive. Sometimes it's negative. And that's not the first place I take people. I like to go for the 11 o'clock hour where nobody talks, only up front. And it's fairly safe, right? But I said, okay. He said, what time on Wednesday? I said, we meet around 7 o'clock. He said, I'll be there. And so I went, thinking I'll never hear from this guy again. And it was 7 o'clock, and he was there in the driveway waiting. And prayer meeting has a dozen people or so, 20 or so, that come. And so he came and sat for the prayer meeting and at the end said, all right, so this Saturday? And I'm thinking, well, let's talk about this. And I said, you know, we normally, I need to go over with you that you understand what you're doing, right? And he said, sure. He said, what would you like to know? He said, well, I said, you know, first thing is, you need to understand who Jesus is and to understand that he's came to offer you salvation. And then he said, I know that. He said, and he started quoting verses and so on. He said, I've done that already. And I have a personal devotion every day. And I said, well, you also need to know about the Seventh-day Adventist Church because we don't practice all the same things as everybody else. And I said, we go to church on Sabbath. He said, of course. He said, I know that. And I've read about that and studied about that. I understand that to be the right day and that it's God's holy day, and that's what I would expect. That's why I'm coming. And I said, well, you know, we don't believe exactly the same when it comes to what happens to people when they die. And I said, you know, we believe that people rest until the resurrection. And he said, I know that. I've read that. He said, I'm very familiar with that. He said, that makes the most sense to me. And so on we went. And I said to him, where did you learn these things? And he said, well, he said, there was a book put in my mailbox. And he said, a doorbell rang and I was occupied with something. And by the time I got there, I saw this little lady, and she was kind of bent over, and she was making her way out to the street. So I opened the door and spoke to her, and she turned around, and she said, I just dropped by to offer you this free book. It's about, you know, it'll talk to you about Christianity and history and how it all comes together, and I thought maybe you'd like to read it. And he said, okay, thank you very much. And he took the book and he read it. And he read it several times. And this was the man who came that evening. We baptized him that week. And a few weeks later, it wasn't long, the next time that the nominating committee did their thing, he was so involved that they made him a deacon in the church. And then the head deacon in the church. And still there today, serving. And I think to myself, that little woman never knew. You know, now, as it turns out, I made it a point of finding her and invited her to the church again, and they got to meet, and that was an incredible thing. And I think to myself, she is a second class, second-hand rose, but she could do something, and she did what she could. She loved people like Jesus did. And God wants exactly the same of you and I. I'm not going to say any more because I find that story so emotional. So if perhaps Wayne, if you would come and have the benediction, and I would appreciate that.